that. Zahra says every capable Syrian should shoulder some responsibility to help others during this crisis.
I feel related to this initiative in Ramadan every year. I can't imagine myself not helping during this month. It feels incredibly good to know I'm helping in feeding thousands of people. It's a responsibility and an expression of love to my people.
We start working every day at 9 a.m. We prepare the ingredients of the meal, such as meat, rice and vegetables. We produce the meals, wrap them and distribute them to the needy, mainly in poor areas and earthquake affected parts of Syria.
The recent earthquakes exacerbated the already tough economic conditions in Syria. The UN says 70% of the population needs humanitarian assistance, while 6.8 million people have been internally displaced. Syrians have endured almost all factors that could bring a person to the brink of poverty, from foreign-backed war and terrorism to U.S. and Western economic sanctions and the recent devastating earthquakes. In this unprecedented scenario, such initiatives are sometimes life-saving for the poor and constitute a message of unity among Syrians. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Top NGOs gathered in the United States for a peace summit with the stated goal of fighting the war machine. The forum sought to empower and organize activists to stop U.S.-backed wars in Palestine, Yemen, Ukraine, and elsewhere, but they know that cultural resistance to peace appears deep.
We in the U.S. are so ingrained that domination of the world is our right. And, you know, being a nation founded on genocide, founded on slavery and those types of things, domination is just kind of in the air. And it seems normal, but it's really not normal.
Last month marked the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The war is widely considered a disaster, even within the United States. And yet Washington's foreign policy remains just as belligerent.
In 2002, polls showed that 67% of Americans disapproved of taking military action against Iraq. But then-Senator Joe Biden led the Democratic Party's bipartisan effort to invade. As president, Biden has stifled peace efforts, sent massive amounts of arms, and created a new quagmire, this time in Ukraine.
Well, we don't really have democracy. We have a state that calls itself a democracy. Biden just had a democracy summit, but we have a rigged system. We're allowed to vote, but that process is in itself corrupt. It gives the impression that we have input when we do not. The people don't have representation in this country. Defense contractors do, real estate developers do, big pharma does, but the people do not.
However, we're a long way from 2002. Many speakers noted the newfound inability of Washington to act unilaterally, which many around the world view as a positive.
And now you have other countries around the world. You have China, Russia, Iran, India. We have these emerging countries that represent regional threats, only because these countries now have the ability to chart their own paths of independent development, and that is very concerning to the United States and its goals of, you know, world hegemony.
The United States has existed for 246 years and been at war for 228 of them. They have nearly 800 military bases stationed in over 40% of the world's nations. Washington's war machine is strong, but activists say the average American's desire for peace is far stronger. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A British public school in London has sparked controversy amid furious parent complaints that their children are being prevented from performing obligatory Islamic prayers during school hours. Michaela Community School in Wembley have been accused of blatant Islamophobia after students allegedly informed parents of several incidents which saw teachers interrupting praying pupils in an apparent attempt to ban Muslim worship. News first broke of the scandal after a petition was launched demanding that the school provide a prayer space for students. The petition lists examples of what allegedly took place.
On Thursday, the 23rd of March, students at Michaela were performing their obligatory prayers at the schoolyard. The pupils were praying on their prayer mats, and the teacher approaches the students and tells them to stop praying. She then says, "You need to leave your Islamic cultures alone. This is the West." She then tells them that they're not allowed a prayer mat at this school, and she says if she sees this again, she will give them a detention. One of the students praying was then excluded.
The story is concerning enough on its own, but what makes matters worse is that it's far from the only example of a UK school apparently showing signs that it may have a problem with its religious Muslim students. Over the past 24 months, multiple other examples have popped up across the country with schools facing similar accusations.
In December 2021, Manchester's Oldham Academy School apologised after students felt forced to pray outside in the cold. In January 2022, Park High School in Stanmore went viral over footage allegedly showing a teacher attempting to halt Jummah prayers. While this year has also seen two Birmingham-based schools embroiled in a row over LGBT propaganda lessons, seemingly targeting Muslim students in an attempt to change their understanding of Islam's position on same-gender relationships.
Don't remain silent. Don't suffer in silence. So in specific cases like these, school kids need to record these incidents and write down witness statements ASAP and then get parents and police involved, because when the shoe is on the other foot and a Muslim child is accused of extremism, police are called in against you. Equality cuts both ways. And the bigger picture, it needs to involve a sustained effort by the Muslim community to abnormalise Islamophobia in media and politics. So irrelevant politicians and journalists who have nothing useful to say to society stop benefiting from dividing us.
Mikaya Community School has so far not responded to the story. But with so many similar incidents of alleged Islamophobia occurring in UK schools, the toxic atmosphere is likely part of a much bigger problem. Robert Carter, London.
A new report by the UNHCR has revealed that women's businesses in Afghanistan are severely affected by the Taliban's increasing restrictions. The report shows a sharp decline of women's participation in the labor market from 28% to 7%, and the consequent impact on the Afghan economy, that is witnessing a 30 to 35% drop in GDP in the past 2 years.
We Afghan women can help Afghanistan economy and people's livelihood grow. Afghanistan is a rich country, especially when it comes to agricultural minerals and handicraft. Afghan women can play a vital role in developing these sectors and contributing to national incomes. However, they need more opportunities and support to lead their business and pursue their passions. This means they need work license, freedom of movement, and access to local and global market.
Here in the women's market in Kabul, we spoke with some business women who told us their stories of hardship and resilience amid the Taliban's limitations. They say they're losing customers and opportunities which are meant to develop their businesses. Some of them have experienced a significant drop in their income, while others fear they may have to shut down their businesses soon.
Unfortunately, the Taliban's restrictions on women have wiped out educational and business opportunities. Women can't work in such a limited environment. Here in the women's market, we are receiving fewer customers, contractors, and funds than ever before. My fellow entrepreneurs are desperate, with some aiming to close their shops and end activities.
Many NGOs have stopped working with business women after the Taliban banned NGOs' female workers. These NGOs used to help us with getting work permits, finding contractors, and supplying some essentials. But all these supports are gone. As a result, we are operating at a loss since we have to pay for farmers' wages and production costs without any income.
Emphasizing the need for women's economic empowerment, UNHCR has called on the Taliban to respect and safeguard the rights to work and education for women. The agency has also appealed to the international community to sustain its support for humanitarian and development initiatives that benefit women and girls in Afghanistan. The plight of Afghan business women is just one example of how Afghan women are impacted by the Taliban restrictions. Now it's a matter of time that whether the de facto authorities will change their policies against women. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The strike group of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier conducted military exercises off the Korean Peninsula this week. This follows 11 days of the largest land-based drills involving South Korea and the U.S. in almost 5 years. The U.S. has increased joint drills with South Korea in the past year, particularly those involving nuclear-capable weapons, so-called strategic assets.
The United States has deployable strategic assets at the ready on every day. And we can continue to deploy those assets, and we will. Again, we really want to underpin the international security and the global commons so we can all prosper. And I think that's our message.
North Korea protested the drills test-firing ballistic and cruise missiles as Pyongyang views such exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. The Nimitz drills were followed up with a massive joint U.S.-South Korea amphibious landing exercise Wednesday. Activists argue such drills carry risks.
The more South Korea-U.S. military exercises are conducted, the larger the scale, the stronger the North is protesting and testing more missiles. If the South Korea-U.S. military exercises expand, the confrontation will intensify, and I think increase this vicious cycle of confrontation.
For President Yoon Suk-yeol, the drills show how he's succeeded in strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol earlier this month re-emphasized his hardline position with North Korea, saying that Pyongyang would pay a price for its recent missile launches, what he calls provocations. President Yoon also said North Korea would not receive a penny in aid from the South as long as it continued its nuclear weapons development. The confrontation on the Korean Peninsula may heat up further with even larger exercises planned to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance in June. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A massive march has been held along the fence separating the Gaza Strip from the occupied territories to commemorate the 47th anniversary of the Land Day. People from all walks of life took to the streets of the besieged Gaza Strip to stress their right to return to their land.
We are here today to commemorate the Land Day to stress on our Palestinian identity and our entitlement to the land. We say to the Israeli occupation, you have no place in Palestine. Leave it so the world can eventually enjoy peace and freedom.
Land Day marks the events of March the 30th, 1976, where six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces during peaceful protests against the Tel Aviv regime's decision to seize tracts of Palestinian-owned lands. Palestinians call on the international community and the Arab countries to support the Palestinian people in their quest for liberation.
We are addressing all the international community, the Arabs, the Muslims in the world, to stand up, to stand up with us, to support us, to support also our resistance to return to my home. We are refugees. We are going to return sooner or later.
The National and Islamic Action factions emphasized the unity of the Palestinian people. They also reaffirmed the Palestinians' right to resist, stressing that resistance is the sole way to restore the stolen Palestinian land.
Today we assert on the Palestinians' adherence to their lands and to the Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine, and we affirm on the resistance as the most appropriate choice to free Palestine.
The Thursday peaceful demonstration turned violent when the Israeli forces shot and injured a Palestinian with live ammunition. Two others were injured when they were hit by tear gas canisters used by the regime's troops to disperse the protesters. This reminds us of what happened in the Great March of Return rallies, which began in 2018 and lasted for 86 weeks. During the protests, more than 300 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli troops, and thousands more sustained injuries, including so serious wounds that led to the loss of limbs.
I was wounded with Israeli live ammunition in the Great March of Return. And today, despite my injury in my leg that might get amputated, I am here today to commemorate the Land Day, stress on our steadfastness despite the Israeli atrocities.
The Israeli regime seizes the Palestinian own land and demolishes Palestinians' homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in order to construct new illegal settlements.
These annual demonstrations serve as an act of collective resistance to the Israeli occupation as Palestinian demonstrators voice their anger at the regime's crimes and land grab policies and reiterate their entitlement and right of return to their own land. Al-Asif, Gaza.
Russia and Iran are in the final stage of finalizing a draft agreement on comprehensive partnership between the countries.
I am very grateful that the draft of comprehensive agreement on strategic partnership between our countries has been reviewed and finalized in Russia. We are now reviewing it again as well. I very much hope that within the next month, the legal departments of the foreign ministries of our two countries will finalize this draft.
The document is of strategic importance of solid, balanced new realities of bilateral cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. The treaty outlines the main guidelines for further building of the entire complex of Russian-Iranian relations for the coming decades. Among them is that Iran and Russia both agree that the JCPOA has no alternatives and needs to be implemented as soon as possible.
We talked about the situation around the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. We have a common understanding that there is no alternative to this international agreement, which was written down in the unanimously adopted UN Security Council Resolution 2231. We are in favor of the early resumption of the full implementation of this resolution and oppose actions that prevent this.
Lavrov said that the U.S. needs to lift sanctions against Iran and return to its obligations under JCPOA. The minister added that the West also seeks to neutralize China along with Russia.
Therefore, Russia, Iran, China, and many other countries will categorically oppose attempts to establish Western hegemony forever and ever, as Washington and its henchmen are trying to do.
Lavrov noted that Russia respects Iran's interests in a peaceful settlement of the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, for his part, pointed out that Western supplies of various weapons to Kyiv complicate the Ukraine conflict, which he said should only be settled via political means. Meanwhile, Russian-Iranian cooperation in the military technical sphere is carried out in accordance with Russia's international obligations. The parties have found an approach in all areas when it is possible to concentrate on coinciding interests and systematically build up economic cooperation as well.
Russia has become the largest investor in Iran over the past fiscal year. Russia accounted for two-thirds of the total foreign direct investments in the Islamic Republic. The volume of Moscow's investments in Iran has reached $2.76 billion. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Thank you.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Rapprochement seems to be the word of the day for many Arab countries regarding Syria. Now, this after many of them cut off ties with Syria back in 2013 and 2014. Now that it is obvious that the Syrian government isn't going anywhere, relations are starting to be rekindled from Oman to Egypt to Saudi Arabia and others. And now Saudi Arabia is inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League and to attend the next meeting, which will be held in Saudi Arabia itself. What does it all mean, and why now? Stay with us on this Spotlight to find out. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. And and Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist out of St. Petersburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Let's start it off in Manchester. And Peter, your evaluation of the role Russia is playing to try to mend fences between Damascus and Riyadh. Let's start from there.
Yeah, Russia has played an extremely important role as a kind of marriage broker, an intermediary at what used to be a difficult moment in Saudi-Syrian relations, given that Saudi Arabia had been supporting the armed opposition. This is what Russia does so well, serious diplomacy. In fact, they're giving the Americans a master class in how to conduct Middle East diplomacy. And this summit with Assad, probably invited, is going to crown their achievements.
Isha, why do you think this rapprochement is taking place at this time by these Arab countries?
Well, obviously, one of the biggest signs is the declining U.S. influence in the region, because back in 2013, when all these countries broke off ties, they were very confident that the opposition side would win this war. And on top of that, they also did not want to isolate or alienate the U.S. By disobeying them. And so what this shows is obviously the fact that the Syrian Arab Army has been very successful in the past 8 to 9 years in pushing the opposition's territorial gains to a very small area. And number two is, of course, the West's waning influence in the Middle East. Just a month ago, there was China brokered a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And as Iran and Syria have been allies for a really long time, it's a natural progression that Syria will be welcomed back into the fold.
Well, Peter, in general, what does it mean for Syria? When it was constantly told, I mean, from 2013 on, how many times we heard Assad must go, that government must be overthrown. And now, years later, the Syrian government is intact. So many of those Western governments that said that, the heads have been changed. And what does it mean now for the Syrians when these Arab countries are coming back and trying to reestablish diplomatic ties?
It's kind of symbolically important more than militarily important. It's been a long time now that the Arab, or most of the Gulf countries, stopped giving active support to the armed opposition in Syria. So it's not, this new rapprochement is not going to change what was already an improved situation on the ground. But it's very important politically. It demonstrates that Syria has survived, that Syria is going from strength to strength regionally, and I think above all, it puts pressure on the United States, which is going to interpret this as a slap in the face, and indeed that is what it is. Let us not make any mistake. This is a big step back for U.S. Regional diplomacy, and a calculated one on the part of Saudi Arabia. a lesson to the Americans, and will put them under pressure to withdraw their forces from Syria, which is the biggest obstacle to Syria's recovery, because the Americans control the area that has Syria's oil and grain.
Okay, we're going to get on to that again a little bit later. But in general, Isha, I want to look at, Peter talked about this being a slap in the face to the Americans. I want to look at that, expand on that a little bit more, because now with Saudi Arabia actually reestablishing or trying to reestablish ties and inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League, what is the difference now as opposed to years ago? Saudi Arabia would not have dared to go against its Washington masters, but tell me your take on what is going on.
About a year ago, China and Saudi Arabia had a long discussion and kind of got into an agreement where there was some military security issues. And so, of course, this means that Saudi Arabia feels less threatened, more confident in opposing the U.S. On top of it, the opposition has failed, so they don't have to worry about the wrath of the opposition, who naturally are members of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc., coming back home and feeling that wrath. So I think those are the two things. On top of this, I read a Council for Foreign Relations report where President Biden last year basically wanted MBS to increase the oil production to bring down the oil. And they literally said that Saudi Arabia's traditional role is to basically pump when we ask them and to not pump when we ask them. And I think for Saudi Arabia, they realized that just being the pumper of oil for Washington is not a long-term viable strategy. So I think these things combined, and also just looking at the weakening of the U.S. influence in this region, has made them think about their priorities and think about their longer-term survival. And that's why this is going on, in my opinion.
Well, Peter, your take, how do you think this is going to affect Riyadh-Washington relations now that Riyadh is making these type of moves that they are?
Well, I think turn in Saudi strategy occurred really about 3 years ago, at the time of there was a tanker war going on in the Gulf, and it was all part of the American economic war on Iran, and America's stepped up efforts at that time to stop Iranian tankers taking oil through the Gulf. And about that time, there was an attack on a Saudi oil refinery by a drone attack. Many observers attributed that to Iran, but it wasn't clear. Anyway, Saudi Arabia, I believe, drew the conclusion at that moment that it could not rely on American protection. And what was striking was that when it happened, the U.S. Ships that were in the area withdrew so that they would be out of range of drone attack. That, I think, underlined to the Saudis that they were on their own and that they were more likely to be dragged into America's wars than have America defend Saudi Arabia. And what we've seen over the last 3 years has been the gradual elaboration of this tendency. Saudi realism, they realize that they have to get along with Iran. We saw the recent meeting of the two, and now this new step goes further to cement the new relationship.
Well, Isha, Russia also wants to help Syria and Turkey reestablish relations. Let's talk about that side of things. How likely do you see this happening? And especially that, you know, Turkey is still occupying Syrian territory. Your assessment of that?
Well, there's two things. Yes, Turkey is still occupying Syrian territory, and they're also funding a lot of the opposition in that territory, too. So I think for Syria to for there to be a realistic rapprochement, Turkey definitely needs to pull back from the occupied territory. And worst of all, in the territories that have Turkey-friendly troops occupying it, basically that's where one-third of Syria's grain grows and a large portion of Syria's oil. And basically Syria is not getting the hard currency from that area. And that is a big problem for Syria. And Washington's strategy about in 2019, the Deputy Defense Secretary basically mentioned the strategy of how they wanted to occupy this area as a way of like starving Syria out so that people would not want the Syrian Arab Army and the current government there. And so as long as Turkey is aiding and abetting that, it's going to be hard. But I also think that Turkey understands what's going on because a few months ago, there was a terrorist attack in Turkey and the Turkish foreign minister refused to accept Washington's condolences because obviously it seems like they have intelligence as to who is really behind it. So I think there are two things. Turkey understands its precarious position and the fact that Russia is a neighbor and there's the big Black Sea area that... And it's like geostrategic position there. So, but on the other hand, Turkey is definitely occupying, was a large player in this war. So I feel like, again, Turkey is probably thinking about the long-term interests and what suits their business interests and what suits their military interests. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're more open to negotiation now than they ever were before.
Okay. Peter, I want to pose that same question. I want to hear your take on the Turkey-Syria aspect of it. And also, can Syria really return to normal when they have such vast amounts of land still being occupied, when the United States, American troops are there, when the Americans are stealing their oil? I'd like to hear your perspective on both.
Erdogan is under a lot of domestic pressure to fix the Syrian file. Turkey has been hosting over 1 million Syrian refugees, and most Turks want them returned to Syria. That's not going to happen while Turkey has bad relations with Syria and is effectively occupying part of Syria. It was always inevitable that sooner or later Turkey would withdraw from northwest Syria. They're not defending any Turkish-speaking minority. They have no claims on territory in Syria. Their efforts to change the government in Syria are obviously not going to succeed. So it was inevitable that sooner or later they were going to draw the conclusion that they should withdraw. But the problem is how to withdraw gracefully. And this, I think, is where Russian diplomacy is key. They've advanced very, very gradually, quietly, a lot of work behind the scenes. But it does look now, with this quadripartite meeting on the horizon, that the end is in sight. And at some point in the next 12 months, the Turkish forces will withdraw, probably leaving a situation, a rather messy situation, similar to that you have in southern Syria, where, again, Russia brokered a peace that left some of the armed militias still keeping some of their weapons, but effectively working with the government. It's going to be very messy, especially in Idlib. There are going to be a lot of security problems. Mm-hmm. Syria will be keen to reestablish its sovereignty over the northwest, and then again that will put pressure on the Americans to remove their last piece on the chessboard in Syria and allow Syria to get back control of its oil. And this question is absolutely key to Syria's economic and therefore political recovery. The top priority is to get back control of those oil and grain-rich provinces. Mm-hmm. But Syria is used to suffering misery. They have immense resilience.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Isha, what about the Israeli role in all of this and trying to create chaos in Syria? I mean, we've just witnessed a few more attacks on Syrian soil. Tell me about that side of things.
Well, there are two things. Of course, Israel sees Iran and also Hezbollah, which as a big existential threat. And they identify, unfortunately, Syria as, they think Syria is a client state of Iran. And so, unfortunately, they see this as a security threat. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the amount of action that the U.S. can actually take in Syria is limited. As we learned last week, there was a drone strike that actually did hit a U.S. airbase. So Israel is basically acting as U.S.'s long arm in the region in order to continue the U.S. interests. And the U.S. strategy is definitely based on the continued presence of the moderate rebels and also the ability for the occupied territories to take away Syria's oil and Syria's grain and other things. So Israel has been doing that. And of course, there's the issue of Golan Heights, which Israel took from Syria. And recently, Syria asserted that it wanted it back. So I think these three issues have kind of culminated in the most recent attack on Homs.
Well, Peter, is all of this what we're seeing just indicative of the end of the U.S. rules-based international order?
Permit me a hollow laugh about that phrase, rules-based. Yeah, the rules that they make, mm-hmm. but not internationally approved rules, not the UN Charter, not the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to which America is not a party, although they try to make use of it against Russia. I think the rest of the world it just laughs when America and Europe uses this phrase, respect for the rules-based order. That means their order,
right.
Them ordering the rest of the world around. But if I may, just to go back to these Israeli attacks, which are, of course, blatant contraventions of international law, and any kind of rules-based order, I think we can interpret them as a sign of failure. The Israelis say they're carrying out these attacks to stop Iran becoming more entrenched in Syria. Well, if they're having to increase so much the number of these attacks, there have been 9 so far this year, I believe, doesn't that prove that the strategy is failing and that Iran is, if anything, ever more deeply entrenched in Syria? And why? Precisely to help Syria defend itself against Israel.
Isha, your overall perspective, the future of Syria, what do you think it will take to get Syria up and running again, a more sense of normalcy again?
The very first thing is weakening the sanctions regime. The sanctions that the U.S. put Syria under is completely draconian. And the problem is that even when something is not covered under sanctions, companies are afraid of getting the wrath of the U.S. and European community that they just won't sell. So Syria has trouble getting medical equipment. Syria has trouble getting ambulances. These basic things, they have trouble with construction and equipment. So definitely weakening and eliminating or finding a workaround the U.S. sanctions, which are extensive. And even after the recent earthquake, the U.S. refused to change it or lower it, even though they claimed they did. They didn't actually end up doing it. So that is the first thing. The second thing is, of course, getting rid of the area in the northeast that's been occupied by Rojava and also other moderate rebels, because that is such a resource-rich area for Syria, and they need all the hard currency they can get in order to trade and get new equipment for reconstruction. Those are the main two things. And of course, having diplomatic relations restored with other with other Arab countries is going to help the trade part. And it's going to be a long road, and it's a very difficult road as long as the US and UK and NATO keep their current position on Syria.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist out of St. Petersburg. And viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a federal judge has ruled that former Vice President Mike Pence will have to testify before a grand jury in the Justice Department's investigation into efforts by former President Donald Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British news outlet The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Former U.S. President Mike Pence must testify in front of a grand jury investigating Donald Trump's election subversion and incitement of the January 6 attack on Congress, a federal judge has ruled on Tuesday, 28th of March. Multiple news outlets have reported the ruling, which remained under seal. Donald Trump and Mike Pence himself have both sought to stop Pence from testifying in the Justice Department investigation of Trump's attempt to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election. At issue are conversations between Mike Pence and Donald Trump leading up to the January 6th and the attack on the Capitol, which is now linked to 9 deaths, more than 1,000 arrests and hundreds of convictions. Lawyers for Donald Trump cited executive privilege, the concept that communications between the president and his aides are protected. Lawyers for Mike Pence argued he was protected by the separation of powers via the vice president's role as president of the Senate, which he performed on 6th of January 2021, the day supporters who were told to fight like hell by Donald Trump tried to block certification of Joe Biden's win. On Tuesday, 28th of March, James Burzberg, a judge in Federal District Court in Washington, D.C., reportedly rejected both arguments. Mike Pence is not expected to have to answer questions about his own actions on 6th of January 2021, when he was spirited away from a mob which chanted about hanging him while a makeshift gallows went up outside the building. Mike Pence has described that experience in a book, So Help Me God, published ahead of an expected run against Donald Trump for the Republican presidential nomination. He has also criticized Trump's actions in public remarks. Trump has said the January 6th Capitol attack was Mike Pence's fault. On Tuesday, Pence reportedly considered an appeal. Robert Costa, a CBS correspondent and co-author with Bob Woodward of the best-selling book, Peril, about Trump's attempt to cling on to power, said, Mike Pence has said he might see this all the way to the Supreme Court. The Harvard law professor, Lawrence Tribe, has described Mike Pence's defense as meritless, saying Pence needn't file a foolish appeal just to prove his pro-Trump credentials. He's done enough in that regard. Now he needs to show he's law-abiding. Reporting the ruling on Tuesday, the Associated Press said it set up the extraordinary scenario of a former vice president potentially testifying against his former boss in a criminal investigation. Donald Trump faces legal jeopardy on multiple fronts. An indictment is expected in New York over a hush money payment to a film actress. His attempted election subversion is under investigation in Georgia at the federal level. Jack Smith, the special counsel appointed by the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, is also investigating Donald Trump's retention of classified materials. Authorities in New York mounted a civil lawsuit over Trump's business affairs. In the same state, Donald Trump also faces a defamation trial over an allegation of rape. Donald Trump denies all wrongdoing, claiming to be the victim of prosecutors motivated by political and racial animus. He continues to lead polling, however, regarding the Republican nomination for president. The Associated Press has also covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge has ruled that former Vice President Mike Pence will have to testify before a grand jury in the Justice Department's investigation into efforts by former President Donald Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 election. That's according to two people familiar with the decision who spoke on Tuesday on condition of anonymity. The ruling says Mike Pence will not have to answer questions about his own actions on 6th of January 2021, when a mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building as Republican Pence was presiding over a joint session of Congress to certify Democrat Joe Biden's victory, according to one of the people. However, he would have to testify about any potential illegal acts committed by the former president. Mike Pence and his attorneys had cited constitutional grounds in challenging a grand jury subpoena issued weeks ago. They argued that because he was serving in his capacity as president of the Senate on that day, he was protected from being forced to testify under the Constitution's speech or debate clause, which is intended to protect members of Congress from questioning about official legislative acts. Trump's lawyers had also objected to Mike Pence complying, citing executive privilege. A Trump spokesman criticized the decision in a statement, accusing the Justice Department of continuously stepping far outside the standard norms in attempting to destroy the long-accepted, long-held, constitutionally-based standards of attorney-client privilege and executive privilege. There is no factual or legal basis or substance to any case against President Trump, they added, but did not respond to questions about how Trump's legal team might respond. Mike Pence said on Tuesday evening that his team was evaluating the judge's ruling and would make a decision whether to appeal in the coming days. I'm pleased that the court accepted our argument and recognized that the Constitution's provision about speech and debate does apply to the vice president, Pence said during an appearance on Newsmax. But how they sorted that out and what other testimony might be required, we're currently reviewing. The sealed ruling from U.S. District Judge James Boasberg sets up the unprecedented scenario of a former vice president being compelled to give potentially damaging testimony against the president he once served. And it comes as Mike Pence has been inching closer to announcing a run for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, a decision that would put him in direct competition with his former boss. In addition to the Justice Department probes, Donald Trump is under investigation in Georgia and in New York, where a grand jury has been hearing testimony about hush money paid to women on Trump's behalf during the 2016 presidential campaign. That grand jury will not take up the inquiry again this week, two people familiar with the matter said on Tuesday, meaning any potential vote on a possible indictment will not happen until next week at the earliest. In Washington, Mike Pence was subpoenaed earlier this year to appear before the federal grand jury investigating election interference. In public appearances, he has cast that action as unconstitutional and unprecedented and has said he would pursue the matter as far as the Supreme Court. He told ABC's This Week programme that he might be open to testifying about matters not directly related to his congressional role.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB.